Soda Days Float Through My Eyes, written by Nose Coffee, and read by Wilfriede 0815. Fandom, The Locked Tomb. Relationships, Peradve and Gideon Nav, Gideon Nav / Herohoric Nanajasimus, Gideon I / Peradve / Wake. Additional tags, Modern AU, set in Australia because I don't care, fluff, angst, comedy, banter, Pyrrha and Gideon reverse engineer Gideon's origins in a coffee shop, Gideon as an Olympic fencing gold medalist, Pyrrha as that meme of Leo DiCaprio pointing at the TV screen after she sees Gideon in official Olympic coverage. Pyrrha does not care about the Olympics. She stopped giving a shit about the Olympics eons ago. She stopped giving a shit about fencing a little before that, but ever since Gideon died, she's had a hard time thinking kindly of fencing. It's just her luck to sit herself down on the couch after a very long and grueling flight in from Beijing, switch on the television for some white noise, and come face to face with Olympic fencing finals. She could turn it off, yes, she very nearly does, but then she hears one of the commentators praise one of the finalists, Nav, a New Zealander, and catches sight of the names in boxes at the corner of the screen. It really doesn't matter who Nav is facing, and again, Pyrrha doesn't give a single actual shit about the Olympics, but she passively reads the names in her jet-lagged, autopilot brain and freezes still, like a damn statue, because the New Zealand finalist's name is Gideon. For a second there, she's living in an alternate universe where Gideon didn't die in 98 and actually fucking made it to the big leagues. Pyrrha watches with near-unblinking eyes through the whole bout, nearly choking, when Gideon Nav takes off her helmet to reveal startlingly familiar red hair. She watches when Gideon Nav's point score is revealed, a score better than anyone else's, which means she wins gold, and watches her scoop up the short woman standing with her coach and kiss her squarely on the lips. Gideon Nav, Olympic fencing gold medalist from Wellington, New Zealand, is an enigma. She has Wake's rounded nose and her red hair, her squarish jaw and sly grin and big ears, and such light brown eyes that they're almost yellow in the right lighting. Wake's eyes were like hiking trails just after rain, earthy and dark. Gideon Nav's eyes are not eyes that Pyrrha can remember seeing before. Gideon Nav has several chaotic social media accounts. Foremost of all is an Instagram profile that posts multiple times daily. There's gym selfies and blurry photos taken with flash-on in parks after the sun has set, videos of her practicing fencing moves, costume builds for Ren fairs with a huge, fake longsword resting on one shoulder. She posts pictures of herself and a bookish man with longish, curly hair scowling at his coffee, and captions it, "Brunch with sex, pal!" cat emoji. Or videos of her and a tanned young woman with a bob cut boxing in an empty gym to Doja Cat songs. There are several posts from Halloween with Gideon sporting garish skeleton makeup next to a shorter woman with a buzz cut and matching face paint in a supermarket, and pictures from later that night of them in a deserted swimming pool, fully dressed. Further back, over a year back, weirdly far for Pyrrha to have scrolled on some random woman's Instagram page, she stops dead because in the thumbnail of a post from 2 years previous, Gideon Nav, New Zealand Olympic gold medalist fencing champion, has long red hair, and she looks just like Wake. Most of the posts preceding this one also feature Gideon Nav with longer hair, but in most she has it tied back or hidden under hats, which suggests that sporting longer hair is not something she enjoys very much. Pyrrha clicks on the initial post to catch her eye, hands trembling. The post is 3 slides long. The first, a mirror selfie of Nav holding out a handful of her long red hair from her head, tongue stuck out, winking. The second is of Nav again, this time a front camera selfie, and she's wearing the same t-shirt from the first slide, but this time she's sporting a fresh enough buzz cut for there to still be little bits of hair stuck to her neck and the collar of her shirt. The third slide is a 7-second long video of Nav, seated on a bar stool, getting a pair of clippers run across her scalp by the tiny scowling woman from the Halloween posts. The caption describes her gratitude to everyone who donated to her World's Greatest Shave campaign and expresses her delight to be back to her roots, i.e. short hair. Pyrrha snorts. It's the kind of joke she herself would have made. Wake wouldn't have laughed. Gideon would have snorted and then pretended he didn't. The rest of the caption is some direct shout-outs to people who helped with the campaign, another allusion to someone called Sex Pal and someone else named Cam, and one line that reads, "My most humble, everlasting gratitude to Harrow for your help today, even though I know it's always been your dream to take a blade to my head, ooh." And then, in brackets, something about being overjoyed by the response. Pyrrha swipes back to the first slide and stares at it a bit longer. Gideon Nev really does look a whole lot like Wake. It's got to be a coincidence, though, right? She doesn't mean to, but she goes digging through the boxes in her spare room closet and manages to scrounge up a sun-damaged photo from over 20 years ago of Wake looking pissed to have a camera in her face, reaching for the lens, mouth turned down in a scowl. Pyrrha can see the vague amusement in her eyes, but probably no one else did. That was back before Gideon died. Back before Wake disappeared without a trace, a positive pregnancy test stuffed down the side of her sister's bathroom trash can. She compares the photo to that of Gideon Nav's pre-shave mirror selfie and has to go lie down.
"You look bored as fuck."
The woman she just sidled up to flinches a little at being addressed and then stiffens back into that straight-backed, unblinking pose she was sporting when Pyrrha first saw her across the room.
"Not bored," she says in a clipped tone.
She has closely cut dark hair, barely enough to be called a pixie cut, and a downturned mouth that's been precisely colored in with a deep plum lipstick for the occasion.
"I don't enjoy parties."
Pyrrha takes a swig of champagne.
"I'll drink to that."
The woman looks unimpressed by this, but gives no more indication that she heard her besides a small huffing noise. She looks deeply uncomfortable. She's wearing a cocktail-length black dress with no sleeves and a plunging neckline, but oddly, she's elected to wear a matching black turtleneck underneath, accompanied by some knee-high block-heeled boots. It's obvious she's out of her depth, and someone probably forced her to come, but that someone is nowhere in sight, and Pyrrha's always been helplessly drawn to floundering cases.
"So,"
Pyrrha says, and watches the telltale twitch in the woman's jaw that indicates she's biting the inside of her cheek.
"Are you here as a plus one, or is this an instance of you couldn't wriggle your way out of a work event? Because either way, you have my sympathy."
She's got to be in her early 20s. From across the room, Pyrrha had been worried she was an actual teenager. But with the scowl she levels in Pyrrha's direction, she can see the haunted look in the woman's dark eyes that she knows comes with age and experience rather than solely trauma.
"Not that it's any of your business," the young woman says, chin lifted, "but I'm here as one of Dr. Geis's associates."
She tries not to laugh at this girl trying to use bragging points about a man Pyrrha once watched vomit into a beer bottle he was dared to deep throat.
"No shit,"
she says, half choking on her drink as she fights back a traitorous giggle.
"You're one of his rookies? Let me guess."
She's heard enough from joylessly scrolling through her muted group chat with Augustine and Mercymorn that John had picked up two new infants since Kith threw the towel and quit. John's always filled the voids left by people in his life with more people, so when she heard he had two new girls studying under him, she wasn't particularly surprised. Pyrrha squints at her uncomfortable wallflower companion and guesses,
"Nona Jessimus?"
The woman looks briefly surprised, and then she stuffs it down and goes blank again.
"Yes, actually," she replies.
"Figured," Pyrrha agrees, not so much smug as relieved.
According to Augustine, the other one is a lot more sociable, but also meaner.
Not to say that Nona Jessimus isn't mean.
She doesn't say that, though. Mercy said Tridentarius is leggy and blonde, neither of which you seem to be. Ergo, you must be the other one. Nona Jessimus rolls her eyes.
"Thank you for the riveting observation, Ms.
Dver, and it's Doctor, I'll have you know." Nona Jessimus goes silent, her face a canvas of anguished mortification.
"Dr. Pyrrha Dver?"
she asks in halting tones.
"The one and only."
The girl looks like she's genuinely about to vomit from embarrassment, utterly horrified. It'd be funny if it wasn't so tragic.
"My sincere apologies for my behavior."
"Oh fuck, don't grovel,"
Pyrrha interrupts, panicked by Nona Jessimus's panic.
I'm not going to be a grouch like Mercy or Augustine. Don't worry. You can be a bitch in my presence all you want. In fact, please be a bitch in my presence. I hate it when people put on airs. Nonna Jessima seems to deflate a little. She does not seem appeased, or any less mortified, but at least she isn't groveling anymore. Say, don't I know you from somewhere? Pyrrha asks, shuffling a little closer. She can't shake the feeling that she's seen Nonna Jessima before. She just can't place where. I don't think so, Nonna Jessima replies. Unless you've been around the hospital? Pyrrha shakes her head. I've been in Beijing, actually. Never mind that you got back from Beijing over 3 weeks ago now. Well, then, sorry to say, I don't know, she says, shrugging. You just look awfully familiar. Nonna Jessima, suddenly, flushes deeply pink and bites the inside of her cheek again. She scowls, obviously psyching herself up for something, and then starts again. You wouldn't have watched the Olympic fencing finals, would you? It clicks. Gideon Nav, seeing her score and scooping up that small woman standing next to her, kissing her squarely on the mouth, and then releasing her, whooping. The same woman featured without prejudice all over Nav's Instagram. The realization must be clear on Pyrrha's face, because Nonna Jessima's goes positively crimson. Yes, that is... she clears her throat. My partner won gold at the Olympics, and the footage of her giving me a celebratory kiss immediately afterwards has gone semi-viral. No doubt Augustine has been giving her relentless shit for it. But also, who'd have thought a link to her mysterious Wake lookalike would just drop in her lap like this? Pyrrha doesn't look gift horses in the mouth. God, what's up with that? She says, instead of saying, Your girlfriend looks weirdly a lot like my ex-girlfriend from 20 years ago, who may or may not have run off with my biological child, who may or may not be your girlfriend. Because, like, who says shit like that? Not Pyrrha. Pyrrha says shit like, People will just see a woman be gay and go berserk. Nonna Jessima relaxes minutely at this comment, something Pyrrha will secretly call a win, and nods, somberly declaring, I am being haunted by the consequences. My condolences, Pyrrha tells her, genuinely. She feels like she's about to vibrate out of her skin. Hey, though, maybe you can help me out with something of a mystery I've found myself with then. Her companion swipes a glass of champagne off a passing waiter's tray and turns to fully face her, face inquisitive. Oh?
Go for Giddy!
Pyrrha blinks and then asks, bewildered, Giddy? The person on the other end of the line pauses, and Pyrrha presses her right shoulder a little more firmly into the wall.
Who's this?
I'm looking for Gideon Nav.
Speaking.
Pyrrha allows herself a soft exhale of relief, and feels her pulse pick up a little, at the assurance that the voice she's hearing is the one she's looking for.
What can I do for you?
What can Gideon Nav do for her?
Hello?
Yes, sorry, She huffs, annoyed with herself at her sudden lack of eloquence. She's usually so well put together. Pyrrha's glad she left this call until now, alone, in the privacy of her own home. Look, I've got a really weird question for you.
Well, if it's my mother's maiden name, you're shit out of luck.
Gideon Nav tells her, matter-of-factly.
I'm not gonna give you my credit card info.
I'm not after your credit card information, Pyrrha replies, pinching the bridge of her nose between her thumb and pointer finger. She goes for it. I was just wondering if you were in any way related to Amanda Wake. Gideon Nav breathes static down the line. Pyrrha hears the sound of a frying pan making contact with a stovetop, hears someone laughing in a room or two away, wonders what she's interrupted in Gideon Nav's life to ask this question right now. She waits.
Sorry, that doesn't ring a bell,
Gideon Nav eventually says, sounding awkward.
You sure you're not scamming me?
I'm not scamming you, she assures her.
Hmm.
Gideon Nav huffs.
How do you get this number?
Pyrrha clicks her tongue. Might have got it off your girlfriend.
Harrow?
Nav snorts.
Bullshit.
I work with her, she hums.
What was your name again? I don't think you ever said.
Per Adve, I'm one of Nana Jessimus's mentors.
Huh.
She still doesn't sound entirely convinced, but she's not fighting her on it.
Well, this has been a hoot. Sorry I couldn't help you out. I'm gonna hang up now.
Her pulse picks up, urgent and thumping in her ears. Pyrrha says, Gideon.
Yes?
She squeezes the bridge of her nose again and releases it, turning so her shoulders are flat against the wall. What was your mother's name? Gideon sighs, obviously a little put upon, and at least a little reluctant, but she answers anyway.
I can't help you with that one either. I don't know who my mother is. I was left on the steps of a church a few hours old. They never managed to track down my mother.
Pyrrha squeezes her eyes shut, disappointment like a spear through the back of her chest cavity. You're sure? She asks, even though there is no point of asking. Gideon would be well within her rights to lie, but Pyrrha doesn't really get the impression that she'd lie about this, even to a random stranger on the phone.
Positive.
Neff says, gruff.
If there was anyone who wanted to know about my mother more than you, it was me. Why do you care, anyway?
You just look startlingly a lot like someone I used to know.
Amanda Wake?
And shit, doesn't that smart? No one says her name anymore. Yeah, she agrees, sounding raw even to her own ears.
Well, look,
Neff says, and inhales deeply.
I'm genuinely sorry I couldn't help out, but I seriously don't know.
Okay, well, thank you anyway.
No problemo, Dr. Tve.
She suspects that will be the end of it. It's not. 2 days after the phone call, she receives a text from Gideon's number. Do you have any pictures of your friend? The one I look a lot like? Just have some scholarly curiosity. Pyrrha bites her lip and thinks of the photograph she has sitting on top of a box in the closet of her spare room. She thinks of the other photos that are probably hidden in those boxes. I do. Trade you for a coffee. When? When's good for you? Gideon is sitting at a table by the window when Pyrrha gets there. She allows herself a few moments to stare. Gideon is looking down at her phone screen with a crease of apprehension between the auburn hairs of her eyebrows. Pyrrha hasn't seen Gideon frown before. She looks so much like Wake, it nearly leaves her breathless. She must sense someone looking at her, because she looks up and catches Pyrrha staring. She shakes the fog of memory off and makes her way over to the table, gesturing for Gideon to stay seated when she reaches her. This place is way fancy, Gideon says, by way of greeting, looking a little out of her depth. It's close to the hospital, she explains in return as she takes her seat. They make their own bagels. Gideon makes a soft, interested noise, and then just sits there, looking over Pyrrha's face with furrowed brows, like she's hoping to find something familiar in them. Oh, she says, suddenly, and thrusts her hand over the table, the flustered beginnings of a handshake in mind, no doubt. I'm Gideon. I know, Pyrrha replies, feigning nonchalance when she's deep down just as out of her depth as the young woman across from her. You look... well, the resemblance, that is, it's even more striking in person. Something in Gideon's almost yellow eyes sparks, and the corner of her lips quirks. Really? Pyrrha nods. Before she can say anything more, a waitress bustles over and they order. And then Gideon sits there, fidgeting in silence. Pyrrha takes the opportunity to actually look at her. She's broad-shouldered, the way Pyrrha is, and her skin is tan, almost walnut brown. She has smile lines around her mouth, and dustings of freckles that are so light Pyrrha hadn't known they existed until she was sitting less than a meter away. She has a scar on the right side of her jaw that stretches back to her ear, and another, shorter one, through her left eyebrow. Her nails are filed down to the bed, and when she opens her mouth to speak, Pyrrha notes that Gideon's teeth are relatively uniform, aside from one of her canines that's slightly crooked. Do you... Gideon begins, trailing off in badly hidden embarrassment. Pyrrha cocks her head to prompt her to continue. Sorry, I just... can I see the photos? Sure, Pyrrha says, and reaches into the inside pocket of her jacket for the envelope the pictures are secured in. She passes it over to Gideon without hesitance, but bites her tongue once the younger woman has them in her hands, feeling uncomfortable to no longer have them in her possession. Gideon flips the envelope open and takes the photographs out in one singular stack, turning them up the right way and squinting at them once they're free of their papery prison. Pyrrha closes her eyes so she doesn't have to watch Gideon's face inspecting them. There are only 6. The first is that first picture Pyrrha scavenged, of Wake scowling and reaching for the camera. The next is a landscape shot of Wake bundled up in like 3 flannels and a jean jacket of Gideon's that Pyrrha lost ages ago, with a shotgun braced against her shoulder. She's standing on a grassy outcropping, halfway up a hill. It had been winter. Wake hated pretty much everyone that Pyrrha called a friend, but she'd deigned to spend a few weeks out at Augustine's family farm in the gully of some mountains in New South Wales. She liked that she was allowed to go hunting on the property. Not that it would have stopped her if she wasn't. Gideon squints at this one, and then flips to the next one, shaking her head minutely. The picture after that is of Wake smushed between Pyrrha and Gideon, a rare occasion where none of them were acting camera shy. It was a New Year's party, a shindig hosted by one of Wake's friends, because John and Mercy and all the rest couldn't be trusted to throw a party to save their lives. But they're dressed pretty casually, and Wake's half pressing her face into Pyrrha's neck, her arm around Pyrrha's shoulders, her other arm around Gideon's waist. The next two are from a Taekwondo tournament she was competing in, the first being Wake flipping a man much larger than her over her shoulder, the second being Wake with Pyrrha on her arm, kissing her cheek, while she looks reluctantly quite pleased with herself at the camera, holding aloft the first place medal hung around her neck. The last is taken from a little ways away, enough that Wake isn't looking at the camera. She's wearing some thick-framed glasses in front of a computer. She isn't frowning, but her eyebrows are furrowed with focus. Pyrrha isn't completely sure where it came from, but has long assumed it was taken by Gideon. "Huh," says the young woman across the table who shares his name. She flicks back to the first picture and holds it up next to her face, putting on an exaggerated scowl. "What do you think?" It's like looking at a ghost. "Uncanny," Pyrrha informs her in as neutral a tone as she can manage. Gideon huffs, looking a little chuffed about that, and shuffles the photos again, this time flashing the photo of Wake and Pyrrha and the first place Taekwondo medal. "What was she to you?" Yeah, logically, she saw that one coming, and would have avoided it if she could have, but the idea of giving Gideon only pictures of Wake with her resting face felt wrong. She wasn't always like that. She had moments. Pyrrha itches for a cigarette. "She was my girlfriend." "Huh." She doesn't look surprised, and Pyrrha doesn't really expect her to, given she herself seems to be ambiguously queer. "Why'd you break up?" "We didn't." Gideon quirks an eyebrow and glances down at the picture again. "What does that mean?" Pyrrha glances out the window. "Means she just up and disappeared one day. Didn't leave a note, didn't call, didn't take any of her stuff with her, or anything like that." She glances back, all of the boiling emotions she'd felt at the time, the ones that never fully settled, put back in their hiding places. "Never heard from her again." Gideon makes a face and squints at the woman in the photo. "Well," she says, and then declares, "that's shithouse of her." She bites back a laugh, surprised and a little delighted by Gideon's straightforwardness. "Yes, it was. At first I wasn't that worried, because she had a habit of disappearing off on her own without telling anybody. She was a very independent woman. But the longer it went, the less comfortable I was with it. John, Gaius, that is, convinced me not to go to the police with it, told me it would probably all turn out okay." "But you never saw her again," Gideon reiterates. "Yep. That fucking sucks." "Sure does." "Okay." Gideon pauses as the waitress returns with their drinks and places a small croissant on a tiny plate in front of her as well. She speaks through a mouthful of buttery pastry as she says, "One other thing." "Yeah?" Pyrrha asks, sipping from her cold brew. "Who's this?" Gideon sifts through the photos and extracts the New Year's photo. The guy in this picture, I mean.
That, she replies, rolling potential responses around her mouth with the bitter aftertaste of her coffee, eventually settling with, is my best friend.
Okay, and he like...
She glances down at the picture between them for a second.
He knew her pretty well?
Pera does not laugh, and she mentally awards herself a medal for the self-control it took.
Sure,
she says, and it only sounds a little strained.
So, like, if we went to him and asked him to vet the resemblance or whatever, he would?
I mean, he'd probably like to, yes, but he can't.
Why not?
Because he's dead. Gideon goes pale, and her lips draw into a nervous grimace.
I am so fucking sorry.
Don't be. You didn't know.
Still.
Gideon. And Jesus, does that smart. Seriously, it's fine. It was like 2 decades ago. He died a little bit before Wake left. This only seems to comfort her a bit. She looks at the photo again, turning it to face her, as if seeing them right side up would explain Wake's motives and Gideon's mysteries.
Jeez, for real?
Yeah, like 3 weeks or something like that. It's why it took me so long to notice she was gone. Pera taps the photo of the two of them with Wake buzzed and careless in their arms. This is probably the most recent photo I still have of them. This was New Year's, coming into 98. Wake disappeared around the start of April. Gideon makes a noise. Pera looks up and raises an eyebrow.
I was just...
Gideon reaches up and scratches the back of her neck, shrugging.
The math checks out.
What math?
I'm a December 98 baby.
No shit. The math really checks out then. Okay, well, look, he can't help us vet my story, but I do know someone who can, if you have the time for a half-hour car ride. At Gideon's age, Pura wouldn't have accepted a ride from someone she'd just met. Gideon, however, seems to live to subvert expectations.
Sure, why not?
She replies and sculls her coffee. Pura winces. Gideon sets her mug down and sticks her tongue out.
I burnt my pile pong.
Rookie error, she responds. No pity. Gideon flips her the bird, smiling a little.
She spends the entire first 6 minutes of the drive trying to convince her girlfriend that she isn't getting kidnapped. Pera's trying to merge when Gideon turns her phone on speaker and says,
Hera wants you to verify your identity for her.
If I was going to murder your girlfriend, Nona Jessimus, it would already be far too late for you to stop me, Pera says, doing a head check and pulling out onto the freeway. I've already got her to a secondary location.
I will require her back in one piece.
Nona Jessima's voice deadpans through the speaker. Alive?
Preferably.
You guys can't joke about that, Gideon complains. Arrow, you're supposed to be on my side.
I said preferably,
Nona Jessima says, not bothering to change her tone and appeal to her girlfriend. Pura does not laugh. I'll do my best. No promises.
That will have to suffice.
This is so sad, Gideon mopes. It's like you don't even love me.
Do me a favor and find out who asked.
Nona Jessimus hangs up. Gideon gapes at her phone.
She hasn't been that mean over the phone since we got lost in Canberra on New Year's last year and ended up at entirely different lakes to each other.
Too many lakes in Canberra. Easy to mix up, Pura says, sympathetically.
Thank you. She wouldn't hear a bar of it. I told her she was just lucky I didn't go to Lake George.
Pera snorts, overtaking a Mini Cooper. I would give you grief if you ended up at Lake George. There's not even water in it.
There is some water,
Gideon frowns, and her nose sort of scrunches up the way Wake's used to. She narrowly avoids crashing the car into the poor Mini Cooper and turns to face the road again, electing to change the subject so she can get the startling similarity out of her head. So tell me how you ended up fencing. Is that a popular sport in New Zealand?
Not really.
If Gideon finds the inquiry odd, she doesn't let on. I started on the sword when I was 8. One of the nuns, Eglamini, she's my coach,
was a vet, and before she was in the army, she was well on her way to big league fencing tournaments. So when I got into swords, she had shitloads to teach me. I had undiagnosed ADHD out the wazoo, and the other nuns just thought it was the devil. So Aglamini started tutoring me through martial arts and fencing, to work the energy out. It was good. Having something to focus on that wasn't prayer or homework or wallowing in safe-pity. Gideon laces her fingers together and cradles the back of her head with her hands, glancing at Pera. I don't know what your story is, completely anyway, but it took me a while to come to terms with the idea that I'd been abandoned. The frankness in her voice stings a bit, even if Pera has no proof that Gideon's hers, even though she had practically no clue she existed in the first place. She doesn't even think that Gideon means it that way. She keeps her eyes on the road and hums a little to indicate that she's listening. Gideon exhales slowly and continues. Yeah, it took me a while to accept that someone who was meant to love me unconditionally hadn't got the memo, or just didn't love me enough, and then left me alone. I stopped beating myself up about it years ago. I'll probably never know her reasons for leaving me at a church, and who knows, they could have been good ones. They could have been really sensible reasons, and I'm just ungrateful for being given a semblance of care that came with getting dropped off on some church steps. Or maybe they were shitty reasons, but like I said, I don't care, because she made her choice and she can't take it back. I had to stop carrying it with me, or it would weigh me down, and I've got enough weight as it is. Doesn't stop me wondering, though. I guess everyone wants to know where they come from, and you piqued my interest. They drive in silence for a moment, and Gideon goes a bit pink. That went off the rails a bit, sorry. Don't be, Pera says immediately. It's just, the sad little orphan routine gets old after a while. I haven't really talked to anyone about it in ages. Bull that you ever had to think that stuff, she says, eyes on the road, voice low and steady despite the shortness of their acquaintance. No kid has ever been born guilty. Her reasons for leaving you there don't matter. What matters is that you didn't do anything wrong. Gideon's breath whistles through her teeth as she sits and considers this. Then she says, You really think this wake chick could be my mom? Don't see why not, Pera replies. Probably solve as many mysteries as it creates. Probably, Gideon agrees. What about you? What's your story? Outside of my maybe mum ghosting you ultimate style. Not much. She overtakes a Kia going 70 and glances over to find that Gideon's angle towards her now, resting her left shoulder against the passenger side window. I entertained doing some amateur detective work for a while after she disappeared, but eventually John and the others got through to me and I got my doctorate and all that. Nowadays, I'm much less impulsive. Are you saying that driving your ex's maybe daughter to meet more of your ex's old friends to vet the likelihood of her being her actual daughter isn't impulsive? I said less, not very sensible and not impulsive at all. Gideon laughs and starts playing with the stereo. Right. Give me a minute, yells the voice from inside. Gideon flinches a little and then makes a show of trying to clear her ear out with her finger. You sure this was a good idea? Gideon questions quietly. Pera frowns. I drop in unannounced all the time, but she is listening to the carpenters. Are the carpenters some kind of harbingers of doom in a way that I was unaware of? She only listens to the carpenters when she's going through a breakup. Fucking what? The door is yanked open. Both Gideon and Pera straighten up, attention flying to the woman in the doorway. Pash groans when she sees Pera and says, What the fuck are you doing here, P? Who broke your heart, kid? She says instead of answering. No one, Pash snaps, cheeks flaring up red. Fucking leave me alone. Pash, Pera says, voice low. I know you. Shut up. You're not my mom. Don't mom me. I don't need it. Bullshit. Pash's gaze flickers and then her eyes go wide. And she says, Oh, hell. Pera follows her gaze and curses quietly, realizing Pesh has caught sight of Gideon. She winces a little. So, can we come in? Pesh chews on the inside of her cheek with malice,
gaze flicking between the two of them. Then she sighs, rolls her eyes, and flings the door wide with such sudden violence that the doorknob sinks into the plaster of the wall beside it. Per and Gideon pick their way inside. Gideon gingerly extracts their door handle from the wall and closes it gently behind them, and they follow Passion to the kitchen, where a Bluetooth speaker is still blasting Only Yesterday by the Carpenters. Pura diplomatically picks it up and turns the volume down to something reasonable, ignoring the death glare she earns from Pash, and seats herself down at the kitchen bench. Gideon awkwardly follows her lead and has just managed to claim a stool as her own when Pash rounds on them with a pineapple and a large enough knife that Pura would safely call it a deadly weapon.
Okay, explain.
Pash chops off the top of the pineapple. Gideon earns a faint line of pineapple juice up the left arm of her jacket, but doesn't flinch.
She contacted me out of the blue to ask if I was related to someone called Amanda Wake, Gideon blurts.
Pash slices a few neat rings of pineapple, gaze flicking between the two of them.
I don't know anything about my birth family, since I was raised by a bunch of nuns in Wellington from birth, but she showed me pictures and we agree I bear a striking resemblance. She said you might be able to corroborate.
And who the fuck are you, exactly?
Gideon Nav, Olympic gold medalist fencer.
Pash quirks one eyebrow, an accusing eyebrow.
Oh yeah?
She looks dead at Pura. She never did manage to shake off those all-encompassing emotional bursts from adolescence.
That all, then?
You tell me, Pash, Pura says, lightly, leaning back with her arms crossed over her chest.
You were the last person to see her. Gideon's eyebrows go up, but she makes no comments.
Pesh slices another pineapple ring and then methodically points the tip of her knife at Pura.
I told you everything I fucking knew, she says. I shouldn't have. She swore me to secrecy.
She liked her secrets, Pura says. Not exactly a challenge, but not neutral enough to leave ignored. She's been playing this game with Pesh for nearly 20 years.
Family trait, Pesh informs her gruffly, returning her knife to its intended purpose.
But I didn't know that then. I was 11. It was downright unethical questioning me like you did.
I did say that you didn't have to tell me anything.
I was 11.
Pura throws her hands up.
You're right. I should have left you alone about it. But you would do the same thing in my position, especially after your mom showed me the pregnancy test.
What? Gideon says, eyes wide like she's watching the closest Australian Open match in recorded history.
You know, Mum was just gonna toss that out,
Pesh says to Pura, as if Gideon isn't there.
She didn't even see it. If I hadn't pointed it out, we never would have known.
Sometimes I wonder what would have happened if I hadn't.
Pregnancy test? Gideon demands, voice louder, more insisting.
Pura, you never said anything about a pregnancy test.
Pura looks over, keeping her expression and tone neutral.
Would it have changed much?
Her maybe daughter goes a bit redder in the cheeks.
Maybe.
Why?
Because then I'd have known how shitty she was. She was cheating on you.
Pesh's eyebrows rise to accommodate her eyes widening, and she glances between them as if she's the one watching an Australian Open match now, her knife slicing uninterrupted. Pura pinches the bridge of her nose.
I mean, she begins, I fucking hope not, since I kinda always assumed it was mine.
Silence falls, punctuated by Pear's fruit prep. It never gets less awkward coming out to people, but she got over the embarrassment decades ago, so it's really just a case of waiting for Gideon to decide how she'll take the information.
Shit, my bad, Gideon says after a brief pause. I retract those statements.
I never ruled it out as a possibility, Pura says, smoothing past it. But the main assumption was less shitty. She was a cunt, but I don't think she was the cheating type.
Seconded,
Pash adds, tossing a chunk of pineapple in her mouth.
That's a family trait too.
Being a cunt? Gideon asks.
Pash tosses a chunk of pineapple at her in response, and Gideon, apparently well attuned to fuckery, catches it in her mouth. This makes Pesh snort.
Sure, that too.
Pesh scrapes the pineapple chunks into a bowl and then sets her knife and cutting board aside.
Nah,
But Auntie A came to see me and Mum right before she disappeared off the face of the fucking planet. I was in, like, third grade, I think. Picked me up from school, told me not to tell anyone that she was gonna be away for a while, and she didn't know when she'd be back. Told me to, and I quote, give them hell. She got into an argument with Mum when we got home, and then left. That's it. That's really not a lot to go on, Gideon says, turning to Pyrrha. Per snorts. But it's such an old argument that she doesn't push it any further. No, Pyrrha agrees. It's not. Which is why I never got anywhere helpful with the investigation. Gideon pilfers 3 chunks of pineapple from the bowl before Pesh catches sight of her and slaps her hand away. But Gideon seems less chastised and more smug. She pops a chunk in her mouth and muses, so she's gone-girled you and may have left you as a single mother to an adult Olympic gold medalist? Pyrrha arches a brow and hums in response. That doesn't explain anything about where she went in the first place. Why? Or even where she is now? Gideon points out. If she just went away to hide her pregnancy, which, by the way, I find hella weird, why didn't she just come back after she had me? They all exchange a few looks immediately following the question, as identically at a loss as each other. Pesh pulls a net of kiwi fruit out of the crisper drawer in her fridge, dumping it on her chopping board. Pyrrha sets her shoulders. It's all irrelevant anyway. I just brought her here so you could tell me if I was being crazy or not. Nah, she's the spitting fucking image, P. Except the eyes. Pesh cocks her head at Gideon and shakes her head. No one in our family has eyes like that. Then she turns back to the fridge, plucks an entire watermelon out of the crisper drawer, and places it on the counter beside the netted kiwis. Now get out of my house. I have other shit to do. More moping? Gideon suggests, hand in the bowl of pineapple chunks. Pesh launches herself over the counter, and Pyrrha steps easily away from the kitchen entirely. She's certainly got Wake's antagonism down, if nothing else. The first 10 minutes of the drive back are quiet. Then Gideon turns to her and says, what was his name?
Who?
Your best friend. The one who died right before Wake ran off. What was his name? You never said. Pyrrha swallows and taps her fingertips against the steering wheel.
That's a good question, she says, stalling for time she doesn't have.
Uh-huh. Gideon's seat makes a buzzing noise as she pushes the button to make it slide forward, her red hair and wide yellow eyes coming into view in Pyrrha's periphery.
That's why I asked. Is it a secret or something?
Not a secret. I just don't talk about him much.
Gather that.
Gideon.
Yes?
No, I mean... Pyrrha huffs a laugh, annoyed at herself.
You're probably going to find this weird.
Gideon shrugs.
This whole day's been weird.
Fair enough. Tell me something first.
Epic stalling, she quips, and then sighs.
Sure. What do you want to know?
Why are you named Gideon?
Pyrrha glances over. Her companion has a pensive sort of look on her face.
The nuns named me, she says cautiously, and for a second Pyrrha droops, thinking that's all there is to it.
Fortunately, she continues a moment later.
I was left wrapped up in an old fleece-lined jean jacket. The name Gideon was written in Sharpie on the inside tag.
She's thankful she asked before they got on the freeway. Pyrrha politely indicates off the road and swerves the car into a ditch, punching her hazards on before she climbs out of the car and puts her head between her knees in the too tall grass outside. Vaguely, she hears Gideon swearing and her passenger side door opening and shutting, the sound of her boots crunching dead leaves and dried grass stalks as she jogs over to Pyrrha's crouched form.
What the fuck is going on? She asks, voice a little shaky.
Just needed a moment, Pyrrha rasps, and gives herself a 6 out of 10 for how totally normal she's being right now.
Why?
Gideon asks, which is a totally fair question to ask.
You should sit.
Want me to turn the engine off before I do? You'll be burning fuel if you want to give me a history lesson.
Whatever.
Gideon skirts around Pyrrha and yanks the keys out of the ignition.
Talk to me, Pyrrha.
What set you off about an old jean jacket?
She's such a bitch, she groans nonsensically, and presses her hands against the length of her face, rocking back so she can sit back properly on her ass. I spent years looking for that jacket.
Gideon doesn't say anything.
That was his jacket, Para elaborates, aware she's still not making much sense. She told me she didn't know where it was after he died. They sit in silence for a few moments as Para gets her brain back on its tracks, cars passing by, breeze swishing the grass around them. Gideon rests on her haunches by her side, quiet and nervous if the tapping of her fingers against her kneecaps is anything to go by. Para takes a few careful breaths and swallows, and then she says,
My best friend. His name was Gideon.
Gideon starts a little and turns towards her.
For real?
For real. She stretches her legs out flat on the ground and leans back on her hands. It was the main reason I watched you bout at the Olympics. He was a mad talented fencer. About as good as you to today's standards. Except he did AP. I was jet-lagged as fuck, so I switched on the TV and someone called Gideon was acing the fencing finals at the Olympics?
Yeah, I watched your whole bout. And then you whipped off your mask and it was like I was looking through a window to 20 years ago.
Fuck, Gideon swears beside her, and Pyrrha just nods. I stopped fencing when he died. The rest of the words catch in her throat, the confession of her deepest, most irrational anxieties refusing to make their exit at the same time as she's yanking them fully out into the open. Being vulnerable has always sucked for her. Sith used to continually accuse her of being emotionally constipated, to which Pyrrha used to say that Sith wasn't a licensed therapist and had no claim to her emotions. John liked to tell them both to get therapy, and they would band back together to call him a hypocrite. In any case, having known Gideon all of a few hours makes this moment all the more weird. Gideon nudges her gently with her shoe.
You fenced?
Yeah. Gideon and I grew up together, and we had a habit of taking an interest in each other's hobbies. Fencing was mine. He was just good at committing himself fully to things. But after he died, it seemed impossible to do it without him. It was like he scooped out all my insides when he went. I thought at first that might be why Wake left.
Seriously?
I figured dealing with me being a mess on top of her own grief would have sucked, so I honestly didn't really blame her if that was the case. But then she didn't come back, and then I found out about the pregnancy test. And I've spent the last 20 years not knowing what happened. I lost the two most important people in my life. And you never had them, at all. Honestly makes no sense to me, because they are where you came from.
Para.
I'm sorry. She rubs her face again and drops her hands into the grass, attempting to ground herself fully. I'm dragged you all the way out here, and now I'm having a soak in the ditch.
I think you're allowed to have a soak in a ditch about this, Gideon says diplomatically. It's a shitty fucking situation, and it's a lot to take in.
Para shrugs. Still sorry you have to deal with it.
Like it'd be better if you had to deal with it alone.
I've become wise with old age. I can deal with my own mood swings.
Sure, but you don't have to.
Gideon heaves herself back to her feet and dusts off the back of her jeans.
Look, let me drive us back into the city. I reckon if I call Harrow now, she'll let you come over for dinner. I don't know that you should be by yourself right now.
Why is that? She asks, curiously.
Lots of revelations. I don't think people should be completely alone when they have big feelings to deal with. Feel free to tell me to fuck off, but if all of this matches up, then you're sort of like my mom, and I feel a sense of duty about that.
God, Para groans, to stop herself from laughing. I'm being babied by a 22-year-old.
Bet.
Gideon offers her a hand and helps her get upright again, wheezing.
Upsy daisies, old lady. Get thee to the passenger seat.
Driver chooses the music, and I have some sick tunes to play. Para gives her a judging look, but obeys. 40 minutes later, they're pulling up in front of a row of units. Para doesn't comment, since she figures anyone who can dish out for a little cactus garden in their courtyard doesn't want to hear her opinions on Melbourne's housing market. Gideon lets herself in with an overstuffed ring of keys and kicks her shoes off in the general direction of a shoe rack by the door. Para follows suit and nosily glances around the entryway as she trails after Gideon. The walls are cluttered with art prints and pictures in eccentric picture frames. The vibe is very gothic heroine versus sapphic gallant knight, which should clash and probably does, and yet Gideon and Nonna Jessimus have managed to make it seem complimentary. Gideon whistles as they enter the kitchen and bundles the tiny form of Nonna Jessimus into her arms in front of the stove. Her girlfriend, to her credit, makes a show of fighting back, but it seems half-hearted.
"There's an open flame,"
she chides, as Gideon hefts her up against her chest, hugging her soundly around the waist.
"You're my open flame,"
Gideon coos in response. Nonna Jessimus makes a grossed-out sound.
"Griddle, be serious."
"Fine, fine," she gives in, setting her girlfriend back down on the tiles. "What are you making?"
"I was frying some onion and garlic. You can decide from there."
"I'm hopeless with most foods except soup," she informs Pyrrha, as Gideon nabs the metal spatula from her hand and shakes the frying pan to redistribute its contents.
"Her soup's a bit hit or miss," Gideon adds. "I maintain the best one you ever made was the time you stayed up for like a week and..."
"Refrain!"
Nonna Jessimus cuts her off, warning clear in her tone.
"You never let me have any fun," Gideon accuses playfully.
"So your road trip wasn't fun? I recall I let you do that."
"It wasn't much of a road trip," Pyrrha says. "We were just hitting the burbs proper, that's all."
Gideon takes over dinner prep and ushers them from the kitchen, claiming a need for space. Pyrrha gets an impromptu, lightly uncomfortable tour from Nonna Jessimus, which consists of the entryway and living room, the bathroom, and a grimace and headshake when she asks what's upstairs.
"The study and our bedroom. Not suitable for guests."
"Forgot to tidy up?"
"Griddle's newest Renfair build is all over the place,"
Harrow corrects, obviously chagrined by this.
"Usually she's very tidy, but this is the exception."
"Really into costuming, huh?"
Nonna Jessimus rolls her eyes, but Pyrrha spies some amusement.
"She's a romantic," she says, feigning disgust, as if she isn't in a romantic relationship with the woman in question.
"What a chore," she says in a sarcastic voice.
Nonna Jessimus smothers a snort. By the time they return to the kitchen, Gideon's created some rissoles and is methodically slicing up a tomato.
"Homemade burgers,"
she proclaims when she registers their entrance, and Harrow fetches some bread rolls from the pantry. Pyrrha takes this moment to duck out into the front yard for a quick smoke, answering a few emails and sending Pesh a random crying cat meme in response to the interrogating chain of messages she's seen fit to send since Gideon and Pyrrha took their leave of her. She smokes a cigarette right down to the filter. After dinner, which turns out to be way better than she assumed a 22-year-old could whip up on the fly, Hera goes upstairs to the study to take a call from someone named Crux. Gideon scowls, but kisses her cheek begrudgingly before she goes. And Gideon chases a stray piece of lettuce around her plate with a toothpick.
"You're a pretty good chef," Pyrrha says, running her finger around the rim of her water glass.
Gideon snorts.
"No need to be so surprised."
"I'm not," she says, and watches Gideon pink a bit in the face, obviously pleased by the praise, if it can be called that. She makes to distract herself by scooping both of their empty plates off the table and hauling them over to the sink. Pyrrha follows her over to the counter and idly comments, "You guys are sweet."
"Ugh, gross,"
she groans, and then beams.
"I know."
Pyrrha laughs at that and watches Gideon rinsing off the plates. "So what did you and Harrow get up to while I was working my culinary magic?" "She gave me a bit of a tour. Wouldn't take me upstairs because of your costume antics."
"Oops, yeah, for some reason I thought our coffee thing wouldn't take that long."
"Sorry to have taken up so much of your time."
"Not in a bad way. It's been enlightening."
Pyrrha hums.
"Did she show you the garage?"
Which is how Pyrrha ends up being led through a smaller cactus garden courtyard at the back of their unit to their unattached garage. Gideon flicks the light on as she walks in, splaying her arms wide.
Ta-da!
It's a single-car garage with a bunch of workout gear shoved up against the wall, beside a row of shelves stuffed with boxes. There's a punching bag hanging from the ceiling, and the bunch of sheathed fencing sabers in the corner. Pyrrha picks one up to inspect it as Gideon starts hefting boxes off their shelves, muttering under her breath. It's been a long time since she's held a blade, longer still since she's used one. She unsheathes the saber she picked up and tosses it from one hand to the other, testing its weight. It feels good. She forgot how natural it felt to her, an extension of her arm. Pyrrha looks up and squints at the opposite wall, clocking a series of clumped-together photographs. There's one of Gideon, probably in her late teens if the spotty face is anything to go by, standing next to a woman Pyrrha recognizes as her coach, Aglamini, from the Olympics coverage. Gideon's standing in her full gear, bar the mask, cheesing at the camera, face slick with sweat, hair flat and sticking up weirdly. She's holding a first-place trophy. Aglamini looks begrudgingly pleased, a head shorter than her student, but no less intimidating for it. The photo to the right of that is Gideon and Harrow, accompanied by the muscular woman and curly-haired man from Gideon's Instagram, standing in a line at a roller rink. Harrow and the curly-haired man look in danger of having their feet slide out from under them, though Harrow has a look of intense focus on her face that betrays exactly how difficult she's finding staying upright to be. The muscular woman and Gideon have death grips on their companion's arms. Pyrrha snorts. There's a photo of Gideon on a city street at night, winking beneath a lowered pair of aviator sunglasses, giving a piggyback to a woman with blonde hair who's laughing uproariously. There's one of Harrow and Gideon standing side by side in front of a big green bush, holding their year 12 certificates, both looking awkward. There's one of Harrow and Gideon and their roller rink friends in paintball jumpsuits, taken by the muscular woman in selfie mode. And Harrow and Gideon look like they're mid-argument, both sporting a lot more orange paint on their jumpsuits and flecking their hairlines and necks than their companions. The last one Pyrrha manages to inspect is a smaller photo of two small children, probably 4 or 5 years old, standing on the steps of a church, one with dark hair wearing a black dress with a white collar and tights, the other in a t-shirt and cargo shorts, both frowning at the camera. She's rolling the similarities over in her head, the auburn mullets on the kid in shorts, the dolly curls on the kid in the dress, the dark, dark eyes burning holes practically through the photograph itself. And then she hears Gideon behind her say, "Oh, here we go," and turns around curiously. Pyrrha tightens her grip on the handle of the saber she's holding as she clocks what Gideon's holding. "Oh, Jesus," she hears herself choke. "You still have that?" Gideon gives her a bemused look, crossing the space between them in a few quick strides. "Why would I have gotten rid of it?" she responds. "It's all I have of her. I'd be an idiot to lose it." She plucks the saber easily from Pyrrha's hand and replaces it with Gideon Sr.'s denim jacket. Pyrrha squeezes the age-softened fabric in her fists, feeling the fleece squish pleasingly in her grip. It kinda makes her want to cry. "It's all I have of his, too, if you're right." Her sort of maybe daughter continues softly, a little awkward but well-meaning. "And I never met either of them. You should take it." Pyrrha looks up so sharply that it actually kind of hurts her neck. "What?" "Gideon, wow, that's weird. He was your best friend. And Wake broke your heart. She took it from you, left you when you needed her." Gideon shrugs and resheathes the saber she took from Pyrrha, setting it back down in the corner. "Makes sense for it to end up back with you, doesn't it? Full circle." "Jeez, kid, I don't know." "Pyrrha, I've had it my entire life. All you had was an old pregnancy test and a cryptic, indirect goodbye with nothing else to go on." She can't find any trace of reluctance in her expression. "You should take it. I told you, I can't carry the hurt with me anymore. This means way more to you than it ever did to me." Pyrrha looks between the old jacket and the young woman standing in front of her like she's getting ready to be rebuffed. She wonders why Wake left her all alone in New Zealand, why she never came back. In the end, it barely even has anything to do with the jacket or Wake at all. In the end, Pyrrha's looking at Gideon and thinking that it barely matters if she's actually her kid. What matters is that Gideon made it this far, successful and happy and cared for, and she's offering Pyrrha this one piece of her she's had her entire life, like it'll mean nothing if Pyrrha takes it. Pyrrha thinks it doesn't really matter if Gideon's actually hers.
What matters is that after all the shit life has seen fit to throw at her, Gideon's a kind person. Pyrrha drops the jacket and tucks Gideon into a hug that makes most of the joints in her arms and shoulders creak and pop. Gideon makes an oof noise, and Pyrrha feels her hands awkwardly flutter around the length of her back before she settles them carefully on the back of her ribcage and relaxes into the hold. She honestly doesn't remember the last time she hugged someone, which is sad to think about, so while this is awkward and overly emotional, it's nice. About a minute later they break apart, and Gideon awkwardly clears her throat, casting her gaze away so that she can pretend Pyrrha can't see her reddened face and shiny eyes.
Okay, enough of all that, or I'll lose my cool guy cred.
You have cool guy cred, Pyrrha shoots back.
Those are fighting words, Gideon says, a grin splitting her face in half again. Think you can beat me, Dveh?
Pyrrha raises an eyebrow and stretches out her arms above her head. It's not that I think I can beat you, kid. It's that I know. Hera finds them 20 minutes later, alternating between some intermediate saber-fencing moves and arguing about each other's technique. She sits herself down on the dryer by the door and just watches. Pyrrha doesn't say so, and she keeps the truth of it close to her chest. But all of it, having some answers to the swirling bottomless questions she's held for 20 years, having a saber in her hand again, knowing Gideon and Harrow the way she does and getting to spend time with them, it settles something inside her that's been restless for probably her entire life. Pyrrha finds that even though it aches, she can live with not knowing the rest of the story. Gideon's probably going to keep her busy for a good long while yet. The end.